Good evening and welcome to My Stogie Mr. Goji with your hosts, Don Gonzalez and
Mark Connolly.
This is episode 15 of season 2. What are you smoking now, Mark Connolly?
I am smoking another one of those mystery cigars that we had a couple of podcasts ago. And I like the cigar very much. I went back to the cigar store to find out about it. I think it's kind of an appropriate cigar for us for a couple of reasons. It's called the Tri-Kappa, but the guy over there calls it the Threesome because he says everybody's more interested in it then. I like to call it the Trinity.
Okay.
And I would like to make a comment, just a philosophical observation about that threesome. Why does everybody want things in three? It's because of the Trinity. You know, I think it was Chesterton that said, every man that knocks on the door of a whorehouse is looking for Jesus. So people are always looking for something. And if it's not love, it's lust. So, anyway.
All right.
I don't lust after this cigar, but I do like it a lot. It's an interesting cigar, and so I got some of the details from the guy. They had it made for them by some factory. This is at the base, or at the foot, no, the foot's the end you light, right? Yeah, so at the part you put in your mouth, it's Connecticut Broadleaf Maduro. In the middle is an Ecuadorian Habano wrapper, and on the end is Ecuadorian Connecticut.
Now, the last time you spoke this, did you post a picture?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. It doesn't have a ring on it, and it's Nicaraguan filler and binder. So it would be a Nicaraguan Puro, except that it's got these three different leaves that they've used to wrap it into.
All right, and you said one of them was a broadleaf.
Right. Broadleaf Maduro, Connecticut broadleaf.
Okay.
An actual Connecticut from Connecticut.
Right.
And then an Ecuador Habano.
That's probably the middle one.
Yes, and then an Ecuadorian Connecticut, which is the same tobacco that is used in the Connecticut, from Connecticut, but it's grown in Ecuador.
All right.
A Nicaraguan, pure Nicaraguan filler and binder.
All right. And I assume you bought these, the last one you got for free.
Yeah, he gave me one for free. It's like that, you know, the first one's free kind of thing.
What was the cost of the stick?
$7.95.
Okay.
So, pretty happy with it. It's a good cigar. Smoking very nicely. I'm about halfway through the Ecuadorian Connecticut wrapper. So.
Right.
And I'm drinking it with that Glenmorangie Scotch again.
All right.
The Speyside Special Edition, whatever it was.
What's the ring gauge and length on it?
This is probably 6 inches, maybe 7. 6.5, I'm going to say. And 52?
No, that's
60.
This is 54, so okay. I think that's
this
closer
is 60.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. All right, well, I am smoking a CAO America is the name of the cigar, and this particular size is called the Monument, which is a torpedo shape. It's 6¼ inches long. It's a 54 ring gauge. And I chose this cigar because of the American theme, since we're about to hit up on the 4th of July, and we're going to talk about things related to being a good citizen and how our Catholic faith forms that. So I had this sitting in my box for a while, so I thought it would be fitting to smoke it and review it tonight. So it's, like yours, it has more than one leaf as part of the wrapper. Some people call it is technically a barber pole, which you see on some cigars, but others call it a pinstripe. And when you see the picture, when we post it online, it will look like a pinstripe. But the reality is that there are two full leaves that were used. I have no idea how they're able to get this look, the pinstripe look on there. But, when I read up on it, it said that there are two leaves. The two leaves are both American. It's a Connecticut Broadleaf Maduro, and a Connecticut Shade. The binder is Brazilian, which was not surprising because CAO also makes a Brazilian cigar. And the filler is 100% Liedo, and it's made up of four different types of tobacco: Nicaraguan, Italian, Dominican, and U.S. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of different stuff, and how can that be an American cigar? But then I read one of the reviews, and it called it the melting pot cigar.
Yes, it's a nation of immigrants.
Yeah, so it was kind of cool that, you know, their CAO was one of my favorite cigar manufacturers when I first got into cigar smoking. It used to be owned by a family. They were bought out by a European company a few years back. And so they eliminated some of their lines and they kept some. I don't know. I know that they still make the America. They still make the Brazilian. I don't know if they still make the Italian. They have an Italy one as well.
I didn't know they had tobacco in Italy.
I didn't either. The band on this is red, white, and blue. It looks kind of like an American flag with stars and stripes. And if you look closely at it, around the CAO part of it, it looks like it actually does look kind of like a monument.
So does CAO stand for Captain America Offering?
No, I don't remember what CAO stood for, and I should have looked that up because I should have known you would ask a question like that. Honestly, I don't remember what CAO stands for. It's highly rated cigar. It's been rated as high as the 92 by Cigar Aficionado. I thought one of the interesting terms that I saw that somebody said, well, one of the phrases that somebody said in reviewing it said it was a robust firecracker cigar.
Oh, wow.
And that you should eat a hearty steak before you have one because the Liedo leaf is pretty strong.
Yeah.
So while I did not have a steak, I made a meal for being Stacy tonight called carne mexicana, which is... essentially, it's chopped up brown steak, cooked in Bertel and consommé and other spices and stuff served over white rice. And I figured that would be hearty enough to fight off any punch this gives me. What I'm looking forward to is from what I read, it starts out pretty strong, kind of spicy. I picked up that spiciness. I think that's probably from the Brazilian leaf that's in it. I've had the Brazilian CAO before, and it's a very peppery cigar. And I read, and I don't know this yet, but when I get to the end, it's supposed to produce some more sweet hints of maybe even vanilla, so I'm looking forward to possibly picking up those flavors. So that's the CAO America, and this is called the Monument. It's the torpedo size. They have five or six different shapes. I don't remember all of them. I remember one of them was called the Constitution. And this one's called the Monument. And honestly, I don't remember what the rest of them are called. But they all have some sort of, you know, U.S. theme.
It's interesting from a European company.
Well, like I said, originally it was owned by a family here in the United States. I remember meeting the guy at the Big Smoke when we went years back. And they just called him Oz. I want to say his last name was like Ozmeyer. Something like that. Kind of a youngish guy, probably in his late 30s. But at some point, you know, they either sold or got bought out. I don't know the whole story there. I didn't look that up.
All right.
So, and I'm pairing this with the pirate that you had provided.
Yes. I got some additional information when I went to that cigar store because we have talked about the Añejo before. And so I picked up some of those, and I just thought I'd share that tonight real quick. He told me that the Añejo is the Opus X with a different wrapper. He said in the early 2000s, there was a hurricane that hit the Dominican Republic and wiped out all their wrapper. And so they said, well, we have this wrapper that's been aged in cognac barrels. Let's wrap it in that. And so it's an Opus X inside. And then it's got a, let's see, I wrote it
down. I
don't
know if I believe that 100%. I think that may be
maybe a lie?
No, not a lie.
He said it's a Connecticut broadleaf aged in cognac barrels.
Otherwise. That part I believe.
Yeah. And the cognac barrels is, I think, what gives the sweetness that you often reference.
Okay. In that particular smoke.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's a believable story.
Yep. Yeah. Limited release, he said, usually at Christmas and Father's Day. Otherwise, it's a Dominican cigar. Inside and out.
So, we were right about that.
Yep.
Oh. Pretty cool.
Thought you'd like to know.
Well, thank you very much. I forgot to say that this stick is also about, I think it was $7.99, so right at $8.
Yeah.
So, pretty sizable cigar for that price, too. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of leaving my comfort zone because it's a little bit larger cigar than I normally smoke.
So this cigar, you'll notice that I've got a good ash on it, but I'm going to post this because my brother-in-law, Markham, he is the king. He's preparing himself for the Cigar Olympics. He sent me this picture, and I'll post this on the website. He goes, this cigar is very well constructed.
Wow.
That's crazy.
That's at least 3 inches.
At least. Yeah.
And the way he's holding it, too, I know. You would think it would fall apart.
Yeah. So I'm pretty astonished. He's got powers. He's got skills. So that's my brother-in-law, Markham. And you'll see the picture on the website.
Well, he's right. That also means that that cigar is well made.
Yeah.
The one you're smoking right now seems to be well made. I mean, yeah. We acknowledged that the last time you smoked it as well.
It's burning very evenly. I lit it with wooden matches just because I thought I would try for a change.
Yeah. Wooden matches that he lit
with a lighter. With a lighter because the striker on the box is worn out.
All right, well, before we get into the meat of our talk, I want to throw out a Catholic trivia question related to the independence that we're about to celebrate on July 4th.
All right.
There was only one Catholic to sign the Declaration of Independence. Name him.
I can't. I know. I've seen it. I've read it. I think he was from Maryland.
That is correct. He is from Maryland.
I don't remember his name.
Charles Carroll.
Carroll. Spell the last name?
C-A-R-R-O-L-L.
Okay.
And there's a town in Maryland named after him called Carrollton.
Carrollton. There you go.
And if you're in D.C., you can take the M, orange, what do they call it? The orange line.
Yeah.
To Carrollton, Maryland.
Wow.
Yeah. And he had a cousin, I believe his cousin's name was John Carroll, and he was the first U.S. bishop ever appointed by the Pope.
Wow.
And he was the bishop of Baltimore in Maryland.
Maryland, yes. There you go.
And I take it that, I think, I haven't done research on this, but I think, you know, there weren't, you know, Catholic, it was really funny U.S. history is that, you know, all these people immigrated to the colonies to avoid religious persecution, and then they in turn persecuted the Catholics.
Yes.
I think Maryland was kind of a place for Catholics.
Yeah, that's a rampant thing. We were talking before we started the podcast about that sort of irony where people who were oppressed oppress. And I mentioned the Eddie Murphy joke where I think it's Eddie Murphy Raw. And the beginning of his monologue is all gay jokes. And then at one point he says, I make fun of the homosexual because they'd be homosexual. Ah, everybody in the audience just busted out laughing. And I remember thinking, how did you feel when it was the thing to say black jokes? So it's just an interesting thing about human beings. We all seem to want to identify with a group and have an us against them kind of a vibe.
Well, that's a pretty good observation there. And the reason I say that is that I've always had the thought that most people talk about equality, but I don't think most people want equality.
No.
And I don't, you know, people always want to be a little bit better than the other person, or want to have more than the other person. I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way. I mean, I just think that competitive juices kick in sometimes, but then there's also kind of that dark part of it too, is that it does seem that no matter what group it is, there always seems to be a group looking for another group to look down upon.
Yeah, and I think this will relate, and it may be part two of this podcast before we get into it, but there's a misunderstanding of what the common good is, and a sense that it's a zero-sum game, and in order for you to get ahead, somebody has to get behind.
Now, what you're saying, it made me think also that there's kind of a misunderstanding of what do we really mean when we say equality?
Yeah.
People being equal. Because we don't really mean that people are the same.
Right.
And that gets into the notion of human dignity.
Yes. So, yes, very much so.
A little bit of a preview of some of the stuff that's coming.
Yeah. Because the foundation is human dignity, but what's the foundation of human dignity?
Right.
So
since we've kind of dipped our toes into the topic a little bit, we want to back up a little bit. And I don't know how far you wanted to back up. You know, I had said to you in our pre-show conversation about talking a little bit about morality and what that means. Is that far enough back? Or
yeah, I think so.
So when we have these discussions, I think that fundamentally, whether these are in-person conversations or conversations that people have on, I don't even really want to call them conversations because let's be real, those aren't conversations that take place on social media.
Yeah.
But, you know, what does it really mean when we talk about morality? And I think somebody conflate morality with religion.
Yeah.
And while that can be true, it's not the only definition of morality.
Right. You know,
morality is simply a system of determining what is right and what is wrong. And someone's system of morality can be formed by their religion, or it could be formed through some secular philosophy.
Right.
Or, you know, whatever other means that they use to do that. And I was sharing with you before we went on air that where this really raises itself is when you're having discussions about social issues in the political realm, where you have people that will say things like, well, why don't you just keep your religion out of politics?
Yeah.
And the reality of it is that when we bring our... Well, let me back up a little bit. When we do that, we're doing exactly what we're called to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if it's in Lumen Gentium or if it's in the Role of the Laity document from Vatican II that talks about how we are called to infuse the world and the culture around us with Christian principles.
Yeah.
And influence them.
Yeah.
So we're not called to leave our Christianity at home when we go to the workplace or into the political sphere or whatever.
Yeah.
But any law that is written is going to have some sort of morality as its formation. It can be someone's Judeo-Christian moral framework, or it could be someone's secular atheist framework, but whatever it is, there is some morality as the basis for that law. It's some system that determines what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that it's hard to get people to see that.
Yeah. I think one of the problems is the term morality is not well understood, but morality doesn't mean anything without a moral agent. And a moral agent is just a person who is capable, it's a human being, In other words, there are no moral agents in the dog world or in the pine tree world. You have to have somebody that is able to make a choice, make a decision, do something, or choose not to do something. And they have to do it with knowledge of what they're doing and why. And their actions can be moral or immoral. A dog's actions cannot be moral or immoral because they are not a moral agent. They don't have the intellect and the rationality to make decisions. They live in the moment. They're not really looking to the future. They're not really thinking about the past. If there's food in front of them, then it's time to eat. If there's not, then it's time to do whatever. Lay down, go walk around, whatever. I'm not saying they don't have free will to an extent, because they get up and move on their own accord. But they're not making any kind of a moral decision. So the other thing that I would say is, when you were talking about people who say, leave your religion out of it, what they're really saying is leave your belief system out of it at some level, which is just silly, because everybody brings a belief system, because as you pointed out, how do you know what you should and shouldn't do? And so there's a lot of theories out there, and there's folks who think that morality just sort of grew naturally out of the, you know what, natural selection. The problem with that is then that makes us no different than animals. If it's just something that's just part of us because it's already there and we're not putting any thought into it. But see, the minute you start to think about it, the minute you're somewhat self-aware, the minute you begin to think, well, what about this versus that? You're bringing some kind of belief system to the table. Everyone is, right, including the people who are saying, don't bring your belief system in, because their belief system is, you shouldn't bring your belief system in. But interestingly, they can bring their belief system in. And why? Because they feel like they're right. But what are they basing their rightness on? They're basing it on something.
Right. The corollary to that, to the statement of keep your religion out of politics, is that you mentioned moral agents. You'll hear people also claim that governments or states aren't moral agents. Hmm. And to that, I would argue, yes, they are, because they're a collective of people.
Yeah.
And collectively, at least in our system of government, the majority, normally, speak as the agent.
Right.
You know, 1972 court opinion on Roe v. Wade, there was a moral decision that was made.
Right.
That aborting a child is okay. So, you know, I think it's difficult for people to have this discussion, but there's a morality involved. You don't have to agree with it. It doesn't have to be your moral system. And I think that people don't understand that there are competing systems of morality at play all the time.
All the time, yes. All the time. Which is why we should think about, what are we basing our decisions on? And so, since this is a Catholic podcast, and it's about how should Catholics act in the world, basically. I mean, we're supposed to sanctify the temporal order.
Yes.
Okay. And people may say, well, what gives you the right? Well, what gives you the right to tell me, like up in Canada they just did, that if you use the wrong pronoun with somebody, you're guilty of hate speech? Don't bring your belief systems into my world. I mean, that's a belief system. That if somebody is transgendered and you say he instead of she, they are so damaged by that you should be punished. Okay, clearly there was a decision made there that it's wrong to use the quote-unquote wrong pronoun, and that you will be punished for it. That is a moral position. So, what's the basis of the Catholic morality? It essentially starts with the Trinity. And that idea of three persons and one God in love with each other. And then God made man in his image, male and female, he created them, so that they could, to the extent possible for material beings, imitate that Trinitarian unity. And there's the fundamental idea behind any Catholic teaching is human dignity, and it's the sanctity of human dignity and how human dignity basically trumps everything. And then what a lot of people don't want to admit or acknowledge is that most of our law in this country and in Europe flows from Catholic or Christian teaching. For an example, prior to Catholicism, and I'm talking about early, I'm talking about Acts of the Apostles time frame, nobody cared for the widows and the orphans. If you were a widow, you were just out of luck. Mm. If you were an orphan, you were just out of luck. This idea that collectively society should take care of the widow and the orphan, that was brand new. We take it today as just a fact. But if Mother Teresa were here to talk to us, she could attest to the idea that that's not common across the planet. Because in India, if you were dying, they left you in the gutter to die. Because you were dying. And so what? And Mother Teresa was, there's a human being here, and human dignity requires me to do something. To make them comfortable. To pull them out of the street into a nice place where they can lay on a cot on semi-clean sheets and die with some kind of dignity. This idea that we have here in the United States, that all these principles we have are shared across the United States, that's demonstrably false by the fact that when we went in and took over Iraq, they didn't immediately petition to be the 51st state of the United States. They're not interested in belonging to the United States. They do not share our value system, specifically our belief systems, at all. And so we need to recognize that everything we take for granted here, innocent before proven guilty, the right to a fair trial, these protections against the state, these all flow from Catholic teaching. So that's the basis of our morality, is the dignity of the human person.
And the dignity of the human person is derived from the fact that the human person is made in the image and likeness of
God. Yes, exactly right.
And so any moral decision has to take that into account. When you talk about the dignity of humans trumping everything, I think that's what you mean, is that in whatever sort of moral calculus you're doing at the end of the day, you have to be able to, at the very least, demonstrate that you're respecting the dignity of the humans that are involved.
Right. And then the way that rolls into your systems of government and how society is supposed to interact with its constituent peoples, and the idea of repression and oppression and the rights of the individual against the society, the responsibility, the duty of the society to the individual. Those all flow from Catholic teaching. Vatican II spent a lot of time talking about that in across several documents, but Lumen Gentium, Light of the World, and Gaudium et Spes, Hope and Joy.
Yeah, that document in particular.
Yeah, that one specifically has a lot to say about what the role of the laity is. But it also just addresses, you know, what's kind of foundational. It basically, I guess, codified it in a way that hadn't been done before.
Well, the thing that's fascinating about that document is how prophetic it was. It touched on a lot of issues that we're encountering in our culture today.
Yeah.
And at the root of all the solutions is respecting the dignity of human beings.
Right. And so people may have heard of the idea of the culture of death as opposed to the culture of life. I really dislike those kinds of terms because it sets up, this instinct for opposition, okay? People have to label things, and then they have to be, well, you're conservative or you're progressive, you're a Democrat or you're Republican. You know, people ask me what my political views are, and I say Catholic.
Exactly.
And it does not track to one or the other.
Right.
There are some Democratic some of the things in the Democratic platform that I agree with. There's some things in the Republican platform I disagree with. The reality of it is that neither one of those quote unquote ideologies is particularly well formed. They're not well defined. People tend to be what their parents were, unless they change for some reason, mostly due to education or schooling or whoever they're hanging around with. You know, it's that old thing, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. But the only way to really describe me is simply as Catholic.
Yeah, people don't know how to deal with that.
No, because they want to fit you into a box. Oh, so you're radical whatever. Well, no, I'm just Catholic. And what I believe is that we're all supposed to love and care for each other. Now, how that works out in practical reality is a problem, because you can't even have an argument or a discussion with people because they don't understand their position. They're parroting what they've been told, and they label and they name call, and there's no discussion. But dignity of the human person leads to the community of mankind, because as I said earlier, we're made male and female in the image of God. What does that mean? Well, the original term of sex was to sever. So the human being was severed into two genders. And then those two genders have to come together to continue life. Despite, this is a small digression, but one of the problems with most people's understanding of the theory of evolution is they're really conflating the theory of evolution with natural selection. And everything grows from natural selection. The one question nobody has the answer to is, how did life start? As far as we know, from everything that we've seen, life comes from life. So, the only way to procreate, to continue the species, is for male and female to come together. It's built into how we are made that we have to come together to create life. This is a profound mystical understanding of who we are and why we are, as a reflection of being made in the image of God. We have to come together to create life. We have to have families. Families have communities. Because we have, you know, no man is an island, etc. You have to work together. And then that basically, go ahead.
What I was going to say is that what you're describing there is one of the principles of natural law, that human beings are social beings.
Yes. Yes.
And I think it was your buddy Thomas Aquinas who threw that out as part of natural law.
Yeah, and if people don't think they're social beings, then I just challenge you to go watch what happens at a football game. It's a giant social event. And, you know, people will make fun of ritual and stuff like that. And, you know, why do people get dressed up to go to Mass? And why do you have these certain things that you say and these certain actions that you do and all that? That's exactly what's happening in a football game. People get it together ahead of time. They're wearing their uniforms. They have traditional greetings. They have traditional food. They have these social activities. We are ritual people, because those rituals strengthen and give meaning to our community. So that's really the basis of morality, this idea that we're made in the image of God, that we are moral agents, that we have duties to ourselves, our families, and to society. And because we have duties, we have certain rights. Rights flow from duty, not vice versa. That's another issue that's a confused point. People think they have rights, and therefore it's our duty to let them be. But what they have is duties, and the rights flow from that duty.
So
what are we supposed to do with all that?
Well, you know, you mentioned some of the documents that help us kind of answer that, and like how we're supposed to act as members of society. I mean, if we accept the fact that we are social beings, then we're part of a big society, and then we generally will find ourselves little mini societies, if
right.
you will. And, you know, like we said earlier, as Catholics, we're called to take our Catholicism into those little social networks
right.
and influence.
Right.
So, I don't think that means we go around with a big old green catechism popping people over the heads with it.
Right.
But it does mean that, well, I think it's, for example, you just said that when people ask you what your politics are, that you say Catholic. And my answer is very similar. I say I don't identify with any particular political party, that my political beliefs are formed by my Catholicism. And then, you know, just like you said, people want to pigeonhole you into, well, that means you're against this or you're for this. And it's like, well, no, not necessarily. And just like you said, they don't know where to put you because, just like you said, there are some things that traditionally are associated with Democrats that I agree with, and there are things that are traditionally associated with Republicans that I agree with, but there are things that I disagree with both.
Right.
And, you know, you're talking about labels, you know, because I suspect we're going to bleed into this conversation as we continue, but I feel like when you start talking about social justice in Catholic groups, I think that some groups of people will just shut you off. Well, you're one of those bleeding heart liberal types because you're talking about social justice.
Right.
And then if you're talking about the need for liturgy to be sound and things of that sort, then, oh, you must be one of those radical traditionalists.
Right.
And there's this, like, false dichotomy.
Yeah.
You know, you can and should be both. You should have a respect for the liturgy as well as trying to promote social justice in the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, I remember a few years back having this type of discussion with the Knights of Columbus. And we had that discussion in terms of political arenas, you know. One of the things I said is that there always seems to be this controversy during election time on whether or not it's appropriate for Catholic organizations to put out election guides. Mm-hmm. And here in the United States, the federal rules are somewhat clear that if you are a Catholic nonprofit, like a church or some other apostolate that has nonprofit status, that you can't endorse a particular candidate or party, and if you do so, you will lose your tax-exempt status. So people are very careful and some almost fearful of putting out any type of election guide. But my contention is that we should be walking election guides.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. That, I mean, it's funny to me that my non-Catholic friends and then my Catholic friends who maybe aren't well-formed, they want a checklist.
Yeah.
What does the church say about this? What does the church say about that? Well, it's not the way it works. Even if you go to the catechism's not going to have a list of things. Every once in a while, you'll be able to find a particular subject matter in which the church will say that XYZ is a grave matter, blah, blah, blah. But generally speaking, that's not the case. I think we did an exercise like this in Joe Catholic when we were dumbing through the catechism, and I don't think cloning is in the catechism. But if you have a proper understanding of the moral teaching about a respect for human life, you'll be able to come to a proper conclusion.
Right.
So part of it has to do with, I think that, we have a responsibility to be properly formed. And that's everybody.
Right.
Not just the catechist, not just the theologian, particularly if you're a parent. You know, I think I shared a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about fatherhood with Kevin that becoming a father is what got me moving in the right direction, because I very quickly realized that this kid's looking to me for to be a moral compass. So
right.
I had to get right. And so we, you know, I think it was John Paul II that called the family the domestic church.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where it starts, is the first responsibility is helping form your family in that system of morality that's based on our Catholic faith, for
right.
lack of a better term. And then, you know, having discussions with friends and family about how this plays out in the regular world.
Right.
I think there's a tendency to shy away from the controversial issues.
There is. And I can only guess at why that is. But my guess is kind of multifaceted. One, because of labeling and the fact that the label presupposes a whole series of arguments and treats them as established, that our ability to reason is affected by that, because we take something that has a label and we act like we know what that label means, and then we proceed to pontificate on that position. And the first time somebody asks a question that points out a contradiction or an illogic or a fallacy, the first time we're challenged and the label doesn't provide the answer, we get uncomfortable. And when people, and maybe a little afraid, because I think a lot of anger is a response to fear. It's a defensive reaction to fear. The fear being, well, they're going to find out that I don't know what I'm talking about. Or maybe I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. And then that idea that something that you maybe felt was so true being wrong, that's scary. And people don't want to go there. So then they just lash out. So the civility is gone. And you really, really see it. I think it's not a surprise in retrospect that you see that in these online exchanges because of the anonymity that's involved with that. People say things online that they would never say face to face because they know either they would get punched in the mouth or they're entirely too civil at their core to say something like that to someone's face. But you can say all you want online and you're protected and you get to bolster your ego and you feel like you've accomplished something. Of course, the reality is nobody's mind is changed by any of that. So then we're stuck because people don't know how to talk when they disagree. You've heard the term echo chamber. When all you're doing is talking to people that agree with you, and all you're doing is engaging with people that agree with you, and everybody's sitting around congratulating each other on how smart they are, you're in stasis. There's no growth there. No true growth.
Right.
Growth is a response to being discomforted. You know, I used to tell someone, I used to say this at one of my previous jobs, if you're not confused, you're not learning. And you have to get comfortable with the idea of being confused, because that means that you're pushing your boundaries. That means that you're in uncharted waters. That means that you're learning. And if you aren't learning, then you're just standing still. The answer to that, I think, is to go back to that idea of love, the connectedness.
About last week.
Yeah, that connectedness that we should all share. And then instead of worrying about who's right and who's wrong, worry about what's true. And if you can pull back from, I'm going to win the argument, and go instead to, I wonder what the truth is, that's very freeing. And it pulls a lot of the ego out of the conversation. Because if you stop worrying about being right, well, not being right, if you stop worrying about winning the argument and instead are interested in being right, whatever that may mean, then you're unleashed. You can explore. You can think. Because if your goal is, I just want to be right, not I want to prove my point, then it allows you to hear what other people are saying. And allows you to consider and allows you to grow. But if you're just, you know, I think about these, was it last week we were talking about the who would want to be Catholic reading the comm boxes on any of these Catholic
yes.
blogs?
Yes.
I wouldn't. Those are ugly people. Ugly, angry people with no argument.
On both sides.
Yeah. You know, in our pre-talk, you made the observation about certain sins being treated as if they're like the worst ones, okay? I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine about gay people, and I made the comment that we all sin, and the response was, yeah, but wow. And I was like, what, wow, how is that different from someone cheating on their wife? Well, you know, it's just unnatural. I would submit it's all unnatural, because what's the unnatural part of it? The unnatural part of it is you stop loving someone and started using someone. You're either using your spouse for a home and hearth and whatever, and then using somebody else for sexual gratification, or adultery is an affront to human dignity, basically. Whether it's two men, two girls, a man and a wife, a boyfriend and a girlfriend, whatever, it's so easy to cross the line from love to lust, from caring about what's best for that person to caring what's best for you. From going from service to use. And so Catholic social doctrine says we should not use people. And I submit that outside of a marriage that's faithful and outside of good, faithful friendships, your interactions are use at some level. And that's wrong. It's wrong to use people. It's wrong to put yourself before everybody else. And I don't mean, you know, you have to be careful when you say that because people will jump on it, okay? But you have to use your brain. So, like, in an airplane, they tell you, if the oxygen mask drops, put it on yourself first. Why? So that you can help other people.
Exactly.
Because that's not thinking of yourself first in reality. That's recognizing your duty to your fellow man. And because you have that duty to help that other man, you have the right to oxygen. Okay? So, you have to think in broader terms, and you have to think in terms of, you know, you need a couple of core principles, and I know we keep repeating them, but human dignity is sacrosanct. And if your decisions don't flow from a respect for human dignity and a recognition that our responsibility is to take care of the other, then you just have abuse. And so is gay sin worse than a man committing adultery? I don't think so. Why would it be worse?
So if I can play devil's advocate for a moment, no pun intended.
Yeah.
One of the arguments I saw floating around this week on some combox was, but you don't see adulterers. Maybe the assumption in this comment is wrong. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. Self-identifying as adulterers openly. And that's part of the difference. Identifying with their sin.
Well,
I didn't give it much thought, but there's the follow-up question was, can you name a sin that people latch onto that they identify themselves by their sin?
Well, that's a good question, and it brings up the whole issue of identity politics and this idea of identifying with something. The only identity you should identify with is that you're a child of God.
Okay.
Now, as far as identifying with sin, let's face it, all kidding aside, at a certain level, adultery is accepted in this society. Being gay was not. In order for the folks who are involved in homosexual activities to embrace their sin and be members of society, they had to push this idea of identifying themselves as gay. It's a psychological response, I believe. It's a self-defense mechanism because society didn't accept it. So at a certain level, what I think you're really talking about is trying to get society to accept sin. We don't have people that run around and identify themselves as adulterers because nudge, nudge, wink, wink. So you getting some on the side, man? That was already okay.
Yeah.
We already accepted it.
Well, and the same can be said about our contraceptive society.
Yeah. You know, I said that years ago, you don't see any Hallmark cards that say, congratulations on your abortion. But they're trying to push that direction now. They're trying to get women to wear shirts that say, I had an abortion, you know. They're trying to get people to celebrate their abortion and all that. The problem with that is at the end of the day, you're killing a baby and everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. So will there come a day when there's a Hallmark card that says, congratulations on your abortion, you know, so happy you had the freedom to make this, you know, freeing choice in life? It may happen. Will it be a bestseller? I don't think so, you know. Will there be cards that, you know, that specifically identify, you know, like a Mother's Day card and a Father's Day card that specifically address a transgendered person? Probably. Well, let's talk about that and a little bit of the confusion that goes on there. On the one hand, you can be any gender you want. On the other hand, there's no gender difference. What's going on there? You know, so the problem is that because there's not a foundational principle involved in any of that, that it just naturally conflicts with itself. Yeah, there was a time when gay, lesbian, why is there even two terms? Why is there gay and lesbian? Why aren't they all just gay? Why is it important for there to be lesbian versus gay? Or what's going on when somebody is female and transgenders to male and then wants to be with a male? Well, I would say possibly because they're female and they're interested in males. So why did they have to become a male so that they could be a gay male? They transgendered so they could be gay? What's going on there?
Right.
And what's going on is a confusion about who we are because of identity politics. Who we are is children of God.
Well, using that, that we are children of God, made the image and likeness of God, I'd like to go back to this, the principle of that's where dignity comes from. And when we talk about equality, what we really mean is we're talking about equal in dignity.
Yes.
Because we know that we're not equal in talents. No. You know, like, you have a gift for being able to take philosophical arguments and notions and simplifying them much, much better than I can. And, you know, so we are not equal in that sense. But the other thing that I wanted to talk about is the notion of the common good.
Yes.
And how that fits in with notions of solidarity and subsidiarity, which are three of the other principles associated with Catholic social doctrine. And that, you know, we live in a country that seems to embrace still, I think, this Enlightenment-based utilitarian view that the greatest good for the greatest number of people.
Right.
But that's not what Catholic social doctrine teaches or Catholic morality teaches. It teaches that moral actions should be based on what is the common good. And the common good means a good for all that are part of that society.
Right.
Taking into account, once again, the dignity of those people.
Right.
And when you were talking earlier about how we can't use people, I was thinking about how one of the challenges with the way our government deals with social programs in helping the poor and etc. is that there's a tendency to make people dependent on that assistance.
Right.
And the Catholic view is that in the spirit of solidarity, of being one with our brothers and respecting their dignity, and it comes into play the last pillar, and that's participation, is that we're called to help people to the point where we can literally get them back on their feet.
Right.
So that they can take care of themselves.
Right.
Because it's in taking care of themselves that their dignity is restored.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that when we don't do that, even great serving charitable organizations can fall into that trap.
Yeah.
Look at all these people I helped.
Right.
You know? They become objects. They become objectified and
right.
essentially marginalized.
Well, and unfortunately, they start to become a means to the end of funding.
And people are never a means.
No.
They are an end of themselves.
Yes. Yeah, you mentioned solidarity, and that's a word with some baggage to it. But solidarity is just that recognition that we're all human beings, and that we're all made in the image of God, and that we're all supposed to take care of each other. And by taking care of each other, that doesn't mean just affirming you in every action that you do. You know, you would prevent somebody from accidentally drinking a glass full of hydrochloric acid if you were aware of it. But if they were to go, well, but it's my right to drink this hydrochloric acid, most of us would say, are you trying to kill yourself? Well, no, I just want to drink hydrochloric acid. Well, do you recognize the consequences of your actions? I don't care about the consequences. I just want to drink hydrochloric acid. That's a stupid simplification. But the point is that sometimes people do things that are not good for them, and it is our responsibility to point it out to them.
Yes.
It's our responsibility. That's why we teach children.
And in that sense, you're not judging the person.
No.
But you can objectively judge an act.
Yes.
If an act is wrong or bad for someone, say that's a bad thing for you to do.
Yeah.
It's going to hurt you.
Yeah.
You're not saying they're a bad person because you don't know what their disposition is.
No.
You know, there may be mitigating circumstances of why they want to drink that hydrochloric. You know, they're maybe a little off.
And, you know, I recognize that that can go too far, too. I mean, we have the these cases where these hospitals have basically kidnapped these kids from their parents in the interest of protecting that child. Or is it? Because there's some pretty good argument that they've just had a kid that they could experiment with for the greater good. I mean, let's go back to Nazi Germany, okay? And I read there was a brief blurb from Dr. Ed Peters where he talked about using if you use Nazi in an argument and you understand what you're saying, it's valid. But nowadays, for the most part, when people use Nazi, it's invalid. But I specifically am addressing all the medical knowledge that was...
The eugenics and all that stuff.
Yeah. That was derived through torturing human beings. Okay? And so the question gets asked, well, what if doing this to this person saves this person? You know, now that we know all about head traumas because we were banging this guy's head with a sledgehammer and we dissected him and understood exactly what was going on, and because of that knowledge, now we can fix this. Isn't that okay? And the answer to that is no.
Yeah, I mean, for a couple of reasons. One, the ends did not justify the means.
Right.
And two, you didn't respect the dignity of that human being.
Right. And so...
And so consequently, it's not for the common good because there's at least one person who it wasn't good for.
Yeah. So let's define common good real quick. And I mentioned earlier the terms zero-sum game. A zero-sum game means basically for me to have all of those cigars, I can't give you any of them. If I give you a cigar, then I'm out of cigar. And so you gained and I lost. And so there's a balance there. What it does not recognize is that in reality, there are situations where I can give somebody something and I haven't lost anything. For an example, knowledge. That's a common good. A common good that is not diminished by sharing it. Education is a common good. There are many different kinds of ways to talk about common good, but that's probably the simplest example that I can think of. I don't lose anything by you gaining knowledge. You don't lose anything by my gaining knowledge from you. You didn't lose anything by giving me wisdom. That's the common good. I think air is a common good. And people will argue, well, you're breathing, blah, 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 but the way our ecology is set up, the common good comes into play when you do start talking about things like smog and things of that nature. People would argue, well, I lost something when you gained clean air because it cost me money to clean up my smokestack. You were taking from people to make money. You were taking air from them.
They made restitution.
Right. You were creating a zero-sum situation where there should have been none.
Thinking of the story, is it Nicodemus who was the tax collector?
I don't remember.
I think it was Nicodemus who was the tax collector and went back and restored people that he done harmed. I mean, popped into my head as you were talking about the smog maker.
Yeah.
Losing the ability to create smog.
You know, so justice is the idea that you give to someone that which they are owed, that's which they are due. And people are due clean air, and air is a common good.
See, and right there, you just mentioned something that would sound like, you're one of those green.
Yeah, things. I'm a tree hugger now.
You're a tree hugger.
Right.
You know, you must be a liberal. Forming my moral beliefs based on sound Catholic teaching.
Yeah.
To be a steward of the world. All right, so we have, we talked at the very beginning that we had planned in advance this is going to be probably a two-parter.
Right.
So just to kind of bring this to a natural conclusion, I think it would be appropriate to kind of summarize what we talked about and kind of lay the kind of a preface for what we're going to talk about in part two. So what we did tonight was lay a foundation for the basis for Catholic social doctrine and morality. We started off the talk by giving a general definition of what morality was, morality being a system of determining what good and evil is. And we said that in term, in general terms. And then we brought it into more specific terms as how it relates to Catholicism. And I think we touched on at least four of the primary principles of that Catholic social doctrine is based on. We talked about human dignity being at the core of everything, that human dignity is based on the fact that we are made in the image and likeness of God, and that that is the linchpin for everything in as it relates to Catholic moral teaching. We always have to respect human dignity. And therein, when we talk about equality, we're talking about equal dignity.
Right.
The second thing we talked about is common good, and the and that's rooted also in the natural law notion that we are social beings, and as social beings, the common good is a good that is good for all that are part of that society, as opposed to the kind of utilitarian view that our country was founded on, was the greatest good for the greatest number. And hopefully we can talk a little bit about how that turns back on itself next week as well. The third thing that we talked about is we talked a little bit about solidarity. I call that the Three Musketeers notion, all for one and one for all. Right. And I think that's a good way to think about it. Also the notion that we are our brother's keeper, that we have a responsibility to take care of each other. And implicit in that is the notion that we take care of each other while respecting the dignity of the other person. And then the final notion that we touched on today was participation. That part of respecting the human dignity of other people is that when we take care of them, we allow them to participate in their own taking care of them, being taken care of, and getting them back on their feet so that they can take care of themselves. The one element that we didn't talk about that we will talk about next week and use that as the framework to bring these all together in more specific real-life scenarios is the notion of subsidiarity. And just kind of as a preview, I'm going to call that the Catholic federalism.
Okay.
The idea that action should be taken care of at the lowest level possible.
Right.
And, we could pull some things in from the Book of Acts as it relates to that. But ultimately, the notion that these are the five principles that form form what Catholic social doctrine is, and how we should use those principles as the forming of our own moral consciences as we go out into the regular world and encounter real life issues. Because at the end of the day, this is what it's about, is how do you put your Catholic morality into practice in life? Hopefully, one of the things that we do here is help you encounter things in the real world and make you better armed for that. And so we'll do that in more detail when we come back together next week. And so that kind of wraps up our discussion about the foundation of Catholic morality and Catholic social doctrine. And before we conclude, do you have any final words on your cigar?
Well, I regret to inform you that I talked too much and let it go out.
He did that last time. That's
okay. Yeah. Didn't quite get to the final leaf. I'm probably going to try to relight it and see how it goes. It's a very good cigar. I enjoyed it last time. I enjoyed it again. I'll buy more of these. I get these at In the Humidor here in Carrollton, Texas, over off of Keller Springs and Josie Lane near the Albertsons for anybody local. All right.
You let him know that you did a shout out for him on the show.
Yes.
I smoked mine down to the nub. It was a very good cigar. It drew well. One of the reviews I read said that it smokes unevenly. I did not have that problem. I normally have issues with smoking a cigar and putting it down and talking too much and it going out. I never had that problem with the cigar. In fact, I just picked it up a moment ago after giving kind of the summation, and it's still, I was still able to pull a good draw on it.
Very nice.
I picked up a little hint of the sweetness at the end, but not nearly as much as I would in like a Cameroon. Perhaps the dinner that I had was hearty enough that it did not have the firecracker effect on me that I was afraid of. At least I don't feel dizzy when I stand up in a moment. Maybe I'll fall down. I don't know. I've had some cigars before that have done that to me. Yeah. I remember early on in my smoking experimentation that I picked up a Camacho that's a little bitty, about the same size of a short story. It was a Maduro, yeah. And it laid me out. Wow. I was smoking it in my garage, and I got up and I wobbled. My wow. legs were shaky. I don't feel like this one did that to me, but it was a very pleasant cigar. I can see myself picking up another one down the road. And, that's what I got to say about that.
All right.
All right. So until we come together again next week, smoke 'em if you got 'em.
Good night.